And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's morning show, two interviews which take us back to the early 19th century and take us into the lives of two of the most fascinating men in history, Napoleon Bonaparte and Thomas Jefferson. Stay with us. For the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, we probe into one of the most important and influential and intriguing figures in all of world history, and yet someone who most of us actually know very, very little about. And probably most of the assumptions we make about this man are based on myth, superstition, and serious misunderstanding. We are going to be talking today about Napoleon. And the reason for our conversation today is the publication of what promises to be the definitive biography of this important figure, a book called Napoleon, A Life, in which we are exposed to Napoleon, who he was, and how he influenced the world in which he lived, and also the way in which he has been so seriously misunderstood ever since. And Andrew Roberts has done a superb job with this marvelous book, and in a sense, it is no surprise. He is a best-selling author of a number of highly regarded books, including The Storm of War, Masters and Commanders, and others, and has done a great deal of work on various historical documentaries, and for many, many years has been interested in Napoleon, collected much memorabilia related to him, visited many of the battle sites and important archives in Europe where much of the information shared in this new book resides, but has never really been disseminated to the public before. Again, the book is Napoleon, A Life. And Andrew Roberts, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much indeed, Greg. It's a delight to be on.
So, in a sense, this is maybe a pointless question, but I am curious to know why you have been so interested in Napoleon for so long. I mean, not that it's surprising that anyone should be interested in him. There's all kinds of reasons to be interested, but did anything in particular sort of prick your finger the first time and send you on this, what ultimately has been quite a long journey of discovery for you?
Yes. In fact, there was a moment, but it was back in 1973, when my late mother gave me a biography of Napoleon when I was 10 years old, and I read it and loved it, and I've been fascinated by him ever since. In fact, I've gone back to the book. It's not a terribly good book, in fact, but nonetheless, it was enough to spark the interest of a 10-year-old and keep me really fascinated ever since.
You say something in the introduction to the book that I really have to ask you about. In talking about how much Napoleon has been discussed over the generations, even if the result has been a serious misunderstanding of him. At one point you write, more books have been written with the name Napoleon in the title than there have been days since his death in 1821. I'm trying to decide if that can possibly be literally true.
It is literally true. Yes, and on top of the many tens of thousands of books written with Napoleon in the title, there have been 3,500 biographies of him. So really what makes mine different, I believe, is that, well, first of all, it's the first cradle-to-the-grave single-volume biography in English to be published since the publication between 2004 and the present day of the 33,000 letters that Napoleon signed during his life. They've been published by the Fondation Napoleon in Paris, a very scholarly institute, and I'm the first historian to be able to write a book on the back of them.
You tell us that among many of these previous books that have been written, that in many cases, if they drew upon correspondence, it was correspondence that had been culled by Napoleon III, and evidently correspondence which was rather seriously mishandled or distorted for the sake of maybe nothing more than simple propaganda. Tell us what has been done in the past, because I think it helps us appreciate then the clarity and truthfulness of what you've done in this new biography.
Yes, some pretty terrible things were done with the correspondence of Napoleon. His, as you mentioned, his nephew, the Emperor Napoleon III, cut out anything that put Napoleon in a bad light. It turned out that many of the letters, certainly the sexual letters, he wrote letters of a very erotic nature to his wife Josephine. Those were all the sort of erotic parts were all cut out, and much worse than that, some false letters that Napoleon never read were inserted into the correspondence, which we now can expunge and get rid of, and not take into consideration. So it does require this new set of correspondence, which is unbelievably scholarly, beautifully footnoted, and wonderfully presented. Entirely does change our view of the great man.
Hmm. And in your view, he really was a great man. In fact, one of the central points of your book, to which you return again and again, is the fact that so much of what we take for granted in the modern civilized world, particularly some of the ideas by which many nations govern themselves and sort of handle matters of society and culture, can be traced back to Napoleon. And if he didn't create such ideas, he in many cases really helped expand them or make them more of an intricate part of life. Tell us some of those ideas to which we really owe a debt of gratitude to Napoleon.
Yes, well, of course, Americans had, before the French Revolution, had already had their revolution. So you did have your constitution, an extraordinary document of the Enlightenment. But that wasn't the case in Prussia and Austria and Russia and France at the time of the Ancien Régime. So when the French Revolution burst into the world and set up a series of ideals it wasn't able to keep up to, as the guillotine showed so monstrously fairly soon afterwards. Nonetheless, Napoleon was the person who managed to keep the best ideas of the French Revolution: religious toleration, the abolition of feudalism, equality before the law, these kind of concepts, meritocracy, ideas by which all modern, successful modern civilized nations live by today. And he extended them geographically, he codified them, and he protected them, so that when the Bourbons came back to power after his fall, after the Battle of Waterloo, they were not able to put back France back onto the old Ancien Régime. And so as a result, these ideas took root in Europe and managed to extend themselves.
Hmm. We're speaking with Andrew Roberts about his newest book, which is called Napoleon, A Life. Much of what you write in this book helps us cast away some of the ideas which have been in place for so long. I mean, they're practically calcified. And one of them, of course, is that when most of us think of Napoleon, we think of him as, in your words, the quintessential warmonger, when in fact you tell us war was declared on him far more than he was declaring war on others. Help us understand how such a thing can possibly be true, because it feels so wrong or so contrary to what most of us have been told about Napoleon over the years.
Well, that's right. That's right. As you say, it has, that's a good phrase, it has calcified. But the fact is, just because they're called the Napoleonic Wars, it doesn't mean he was responsible for them all. He was responsible for an appallingly opportunistic attack on Spain and Portugal in 1807 and 1808, which went disastrously wrong for him. He was also, of course, responsible for the 1812 campaign against Russia, which broke his army and effectively led to his downfall. But he was not responsible for either of the two wars of the coalitions that started when he was only an artillery lieutenant after the French Revolution. Those were attempts by the Austrians and the Prussians to crush the French Revolution, strangle it in its cradle. He can't be blamed for those. Neither can he be blamed for the subsequent five wars of the coalitions. There were in all seven coalition wars, which were all declared against him, rather than him declaring them on anyone else. And he also tried to make peace in each of those five wars. The fact was, though, that he was a great military leader and a great general who knew that in his 60 battles he won 46 of them and drew 7 of them. So he didn't shrink away from an attack when it was made on him. But nonetheless, he cannot be blamed for all of the wars of the Napoleonic Wars.
To what extent was Napoleon revolutionary in his military thinking or in the way that he led troops into battle? Did he operate by the standard practices of the day, but just do it very well? Or were there ways in which he was really, in a sense, an original thinker or innovator in this respect?
It was a little bit of both. After France's defeat in the Spanish War of the 7 Years' War in 1763, a lot of French thinkers, military thinkers, came up with some great ideas for how armies could be modernized. The best idea being the corps system. So instead of having huge amounts of infantry, cavalry, and artillery all separate, you created mini armies, corps, which had a few infantry, cavalry, and artillery in them, and they were able, therefore, to maneuver separately and to get to battlefields in such a way that they could outmaneuver the enemy and go round the flanks and so on. And Napoleon, although he didn't invent that concept, was the first person to perfect it and to unleash it on an unsuspecting Europe. By 1812, all the other countries in Europe had adopted it, and of course it stayed in the military lexicon until 1945. So he was somebody who didn't originally come up with the idea, but he used it, and he also, through things like speeding up the armies. In the old days, people would stop and besiege cities. He didn't do that. He concentrated on the enemy army, tried to destroy it in the field, and realized that the city would fall afterwards if he had managed to achieve that. So in that sense, he was an innovator as well.
Mm. You write at one point, Napoleon represented the Enlightenment on horseback. What do you mean by that phrase?
Well, I very much mean the ideas that he took from Rousseau and Voltaire and the other Enlightenment thinkers. These ideas of, as I mentioned earlier, meritocracy and equality before the law, which you didn't see in many of the European states at the time. When he went into, for example, Italy and Germany, one of the first things he would do would be to liberate the Jews. He would let them out of their ghettos. He would stop them wearing the yellow star. He would allow them to have civil and religious liberty. And he would, in places like Malta, for example, stop them from being sold into slavery and allow them to build synagogues for the first time. Now, that is Enlightenment thinking. But it wouldn't have been able to have happened unless he had been on horseback, unless his armies had been successful in the field. So the abolition of the Spanish Inquisition, for example, in Spain, was an integral part of what he was trying to do for Europe.
Hmm. Among the notable events in Napoleon's career was his decision to invade Russia, which you caution us to say was not in and of itself his worst mistake or most foolish mistake. For however disastrous it ultimately turned out to be, there were reasons why he did that. Say a word about this really critical moment in Napoleon's life and career.
Yes. The invasion of Russia in 1812 has been totally misunderstood. It's always been seen by historians as an example of the Napoleon complex. Now, I don't believe Napoleon had a Napoleon complex. I don't believe that one can see hubris leading to nemesis in that classic ancient Greek dramatic trope. In fact, he had perfectly rational, logical reasons to invade Russia. He didn't want to go as far as Moscow. He just wanted to fight a battle on the borders of Moscow, but got sucked further in But nonetheless, he had an army twice the size of the Russians. He had defeated the Russians twice before. He had no idea that that typhus was going to destroy so many of his men. It was a disease that wasn't even diagnosed until 1911, nearly 100 years later. And he had no idea that the Russians were going to have this scorched earth policy by which they actually burnt down two-thirds of their own co-capital, Moscow. So so many of these assumptions made about Napoleon, that he almost went mad with power and became a sort of almost a lunatic at the end of his career, are completely wrong. In fact, he had plans to stop earlier at Vitebsk and Smolensk, which of course he should have done, and he also allowed enough time to get from Moscow to Smolensk, even more time than he had taken getting from Smolensk to Moscow. So the idea that he didn't know that Russia had a bad winter is also an absurdity. No, the major problem came when he took a decision, one of many thousands that he took, of course, as a soldier, after the Battle of Maloyaroslavets in October 1812, to go north rather than to go west. And he took that decision. It was turned out to be a disastrous one, and it led to the horrors, the cannibalism, and all the rest of the retreat from Moscow.
Hmm. It's so intriguing, isn't it, that when we think of Napoleon, we immediately think of Waterloo. And of course, we can think of probably a lot of important figures in history whose careers ended with some kind of catastrophic reversal, but it might not be a name that resonates the way the name Waterloo resonates, and it really colors our perception of who he was.
That's right, yes. He most definitely did meet his Waterloo on the 18th of June 1815. And it was a very strange battle, really, in that he broke all of his military maxims, all of the rules by which he had done so well up until then. And only the previous year, in 1814, he had won four victories in 5 days. But at Waterloo, it all collapsed. And part of it was, as I say, not just that he was absolutely against one of the greatest, if not the greatest, British general in the Duke of Wellington, but also because he split his army just before the battle, which was a disastrous thing to do. He didn't know where the Prussians were. His intelligence failed him. He started the battle far too late. It was a series of mistakes that that all go against his own military maxims.
Mm. We have to hurry through two last questions, and I regret that because they're two very interesting matters. One of them is Napoleon and Josephine, and one of the most important things your book does is to sort of recast that relationship, which in your view was in no way a Romeo and Juliet relationship.
It really wasn't. She was unfaithful to him within weeks of the marriage. And he found out 2 years later when he was in the desert outside Cairo. And at that point, he embarked on the first of what I've identified as 22 love affairs with various mistresses. So no, it certainly wasn't Romeo and Juliet. However, they did actually for 10 years have a happy happy relationship. They got on well. It's a far more complex, far more human, far more interesting story than the classic Romeo and Juliet one.
You have already mentioned the 33,000 signed letters of Napoleon, which you have utilized in crafting this biography. In what way do these letters let us into kind of the inner chambers of Napoleon's soul and heart? I mean, how personal are these letters?
No, it's a very good question. They're immensely personal, all of them. As I say, he signed all of them. They're to his closest confidants, his friends, his mistresses, his wives, his palace officials, his marshals and generals, of course, and his ministers. And they show the passion of the man, a deeply, deeply passionate individual, one who could write. He had the most beautiful written style, but also a man who could compartmentalize his life and his mind to such a degree that when he's moving armies across Europe, he's also writing to the prefect of Genoa to say, tell him to stop taking his mistress to the opera. Or when, just before the Battle of Borodino, he is this huge battle is about to start, he's sitting down the night before and writing the rules and regulations of the Comédie Française back in Paris. This is an astonishing account. And when the Kremlin is almost burnt down in 1812, and he returns to Moscow and goes back into the Kremlin, which has just been saved from being burnt down, he then actually writes the rules of a girls' school at Saint-Denis outside Paris that he wants to build. I mean, this is an extraordinary mind, a capacity for multitasking, which is truly astonishing.
He's an astonishing figure in many ways. At one point you write, Napoleon convinced his followers they were taking part in an adventure, a pageant, an experiment, and a story whose sheer splendor would draw the attention of posterity for centuries. He was able to impart to ordinary people the sense that their lives, and if necessary their deaths in battle, mattered in the context of great events. They too could make history. The book again is called Napoleon, A Life, and the author, Andrew Roberts. Andrew Roberts, congratulations. You must be so justifiably proud of this accomplishment, and I'm so glad we got to talk today on The Morning Show about your marvelous book. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate it. Great honor.
In part two of today's morning show here on WGTD, we're going to look back at yet another compelling and somewhat controversial figure from the same moment in our history, namely the third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, the subject of a fascinating new book by best-selling author John Meacham, a book called Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. John Meacham, a highly regarded author, a former editor of both Newsweek and Time, is best known recently for a best-selling book about our seventh president, Andrew Jackson. And I had the pleasure of speaking with John Meacham a decade ago about another book which focused on the friendship between Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. Again, this latest book by John Meacham, published by Random House, is called Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. I am sort of struck by the difference between writing a book about, for instance, Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, where you conceivably could have, I don't remember now, but you could conceivably could have spoken to people who knew both of those men, or yep, certainly were close to them in one way or another. When one reaches back to the early 19th century, to someone who died in 1826, I should think it is a profoundly different experience. Tell us what is challenging about reaching back to a figure like Andrew Jackson, or even earlier, to a figure like Thomas Jefferson.
Well, you're exactly right. The interviews are harder to get. they require, you know, Henry Wallace and mediums. What's complicated about it is, well, it's at once, like everything, it's at once more complicated and more simple, because you are confronted with this vast documentary record, particularly in Jefferson's case, more than 22,000 letters, and you know, all the scholarship, all of the contemporary letters from the early Republic. He played a major role in basically every political event of note, roughly from the time he went to Philadelphia in 1775 as a delegate to the Continental Congress, really until he died. So through the Missouri Compromise up to the presidency of John Quincy Adams. So it's an enormous life, and a little bit like Churchill's in that way, in that he had a hand in so many things. What one has to do is really read, not between the lines necessarily, but always read in context what these daily letters were like. Because, you know, for the 18th and 19th century, their letters were like our phone calls, or our emails now, I guess. They were expressions of the thoughts of a moment. And oftentimes, you know, we tend to privilege, to use that term, anything written as a clearly thought out, firmly held belief. With someone like Jefferson, he was restlessly intellectual. He was relentlessly curious, prolific letter writer. Anything that struck him, he would write a letter. And because he was so eloquent, these things sometimes slip into secondary literature as Jeffersonian convictions, when, in fact, the task for someone like me is to go back and try to recreate what was going on that week, what was happening that day that made him so pro-French or so anti-Adams or whatever it would be. And so, in a way, it's more of a detective story the farther back you go, because you're dealing with a written trail of clues, as opposed to the more contemporary figures, where you're right, you can more easily capture the sense and smell of a room. I think I interviewed the last 11 or 12 people who had been in the room together with Roosevelt and Churchill, and they'd all been younger, obviously, children, young age, but they were still very tactile, very human to them. With Jefferson, with Adams, with Washington, you know, you're using a documentary record to recreate the world.
And of course, as you've already touched on, Thomas Jefferson was a man, in a sense, riddled with contradictions. And it to phrase it that way is, in a sense, to cast it in a really maybe more negative light than is necessary. But I mean, the fact remains that for someone who is trying to paint a rich, full portrait of the man, that's one of the biggest challenges. The fact that I suppose most human beings are complicated, but is it fair to say Thomas Jefferson was more complicated than most?
You know, I sometimes say politicians are like all of us, only more so. and Jefferson is very much like that. He was riddled with contradictions is a totally fair way to put it. He was capable of a level of cognitive dissonance, of holding two opposing ideas in his head at an epic level. But I would argue that many great political leaders, many people who have been in the arena constrained by time and chance, yet trying to move things forward in a certain direction amid the conflicting forces of our time, many of those politicians have had these kinds of contradictions. Jefferson is epic in this sense because his were so fundamental. No one articulated the promise of America more brilliantly or more evocatively than Thomas Jefferson. President Obama's inaugural address a few weeks ago was shot through with Jeffersonian language. And Obama didn't even have to quote him. People just knew it. When you talk about all men are created equal, when you talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, nobody thinks you're talking about James Madison or Alexander Hamilton or John Adams or George Washington. They know you're talking about Jefferson. So he was this immensely prophetic, eloquent figure. So he articulated the best we could be. But he also showed us what we all too often are, which is flawed, sinful, and falling short of those ideals. And one of the things that I found so fascinating in doing this book was James Part, a great 19th century biographer who'd also written about Andrew Jackson, wrote at the end of his Jefferson book in the early 1870s, I think. He said, if America is right, then Jefferson is right. But if Jefferson was wrong, then America is wrong. You know, that's a hell of a burden to put on any one person. You don't hear that about Washington. You don't hear that about Hamilton. You don't hear that about Adams. You don't hear that about Madison. There's something about Jefferson in his vividness of character, in his, I think, really self-evident, to use Benjamin Franklin's edit from the Declaration of Independence, his evident struggles with the ideal and the real, that makes him resonate from age to age. He's the one founder that I would really like to sit and have dinner with. I'd love to meet the rest of them, obviously. But if I had to choose, I would want to talk to Jefferson, in part because you could talk about anything. And I think that's part of the reason he still lives in our imaginations.
We're speaking today with John Meacham, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, talking about his newest bestseller called Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. You just touched on something I was so anxious to ask you about, as you just now talked about balancing the ideal with the real. One of the things that leapt out from me as I read your book was two notions of Thomas Jefferson. First of all, that he was, on the one hand, a very cerebral sort of figure, and on the other hand, a real pragmatist. And I think most of us think of those as two different universes, or at least two different solar systems, or maybe two different planets, but we don't often think of someone being intensely cerebral and a pragmatist, able to get things done. And to whatever extent that is a rare duality to find in one person, we find that in Thomas Jefferson. How did he manage to be both of those things?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, that duality, which is a wonderful way to put it, I think is the hallmark of our greatest leaders. And one thing, a game to play, if you're having a dorky night where you need a game, is can you think of a great American leader who did not have that duality? That is, who could not project a vision of a better future, of an optimistic vision of the country, of what the country could be, while also possessing the legislative and practical skills to bring that ideal closer to reality. Lincoln could do it, FDR could do it, John Kennedy could do it, Ronald Reagan could do it, Bill Clinton could do it. But they're not, when you think about it, Jefferson, when you think about it, they're, as you say, they're not exactly natural allies, because to project a vision, prophets can do that, priests, philosophers, intellectuals. There are people who can see forward and inspire. And then there are the purely legislative mechanics. You know, there are the people who can fix things. We get great leaders when we get people who are skilled in both those arts. That's what I call the art of power. And in the book, is that the art of this, and it's not a science, it is an art, is being able to project an ideal and having the skills to bring it closer to reality. And Jefferson, from age to age, was able to do that. It was one of the things, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, is I believed that in the popular mind, Jefferson either was seen as a hopelessly irredeemable slave owner. You know, that's where the post-war scholarship, post-World War II scholarship largely was. Or this kind of airy philosopher, the man of Monticello, who was, you know, inventing telescopes, and, you know, he was sort of Galileo with a Virginia accent. You know, there was a kind of sense that he was not attached to reality, which is partly the way he wanted to be seen. You know, the tombstone that says he was the author of the Declaration of Independence, of the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, and the founder of the University of Virginia, I think is one of the great acts of misdirection in American history, because he wanted to be remembered for these noble intellectual achievements, because he figured there would be less controversy about those than anything he had done in his political life. Yet, from 1769 until 1809, for those biblical 40 years, he was almost constantly in public office. But he knew that politics was inherently controversial, and he didn't like controversy. So, in a weird way, he was ambivalent about what he was best at. But a lot of people, I know a lot of people who are like that, you know, who are really good at something, and because they're really good at it, they don't value it. And that's a question for everyone's psychiatrist. But it's it is a reality. It's a human characteristic. I think that the ability to be either an idealistic realist or a realistic idealist is an incredibly important American political skill.
When we are looking at Thomas Jefferson, we, of course, are looking at such a fascinating part of our nation's history, and not just that those turbulent times in which our nation first took shape and began its life. But those first years of the United States of America, in which there is a painful divide politically, that a lot of us today still do not begin to really understand. Help us understand sort of that basic divide in governance that marks so much of the very first years of the 19th century, and where Jefferson fell in terms of that divide.
Well, it's exactly right. It's if you don't understand that division that sprung up most vividly in the 1790s, then American history doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I think in the popular mind, we go from 1776 to the Constitutional Convention, and then pretty soon it's Fort Sumter. And that's understandable. I mean, we all condense things. The critical division that became very apparent in 1790, the first full year of the Washington administration. Washington had taken office on April 30th, 1789. Jefferson has returned from France, become Secretary of State. Hamilton has become the Secretary of the Treasury. Adams is Vice President. They go to war, Hamilton and Jefferson, as Jefferson put it, like two cocks in a pit. You know, they were just constantly at each other's throats. And the questions were about the role of the federal government, the role of the financial sector, the fight between strict construction of the Constitution and a broader construction. They divided pretty quickly into what were known as Federalists, which was the more of the Washington, Hamilton, Adams party, and the Republicans, who were not the Republicans of Lincoln, but the first Republicans, which was Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Gallatin, who were more oriented toward France and decentralized power, whereas the Federalists were more oriented toward centralized power and Britain. My belief, my argument, is that the fear of a British return to power, of a British reconnaissance mission on the American experiment, was the driving political force in Thomas Jefferson's political imagination in the 1790s. And that the war itself, the American Revolution, should be seen, in my argument, not as a 5-6 year war that ran from 76 to 82, 83, but a 50-year war that was sometimes hot, sometimes cold, sometimes quite present, sometimes latent, but always there, really from 1763 and the end of the French and Indian War all the way through the Treaty of Ghent and the end of the War of 1812 and 1815. Now, the good thing about that argument is the British did come back, so Jefferson wins the argument. There did have to be a ratifying conflict to make sure that the British monarchy would not attempt to reclaim its colonies. Which, when you think about it, why wouldn't they try? Right? It was a damn miracle that the American Revolution went the way it did militarily anyway. But that question, the question of would we be more open, more cooperative with London, or would we ally ourselves more with Paris, was a central question in the life of the Republic and totally defined our politics. A lot of people don't realize that foreign policy was that important. But for Jefferson and Hamilton, foreign policy was so intimately connected to domestic policy, since we didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know if the country was going to make it. Mm. Nothing like it ever had. So it was a reasonable fear.
Your book, of course, begins in such dramatic fashion early in 1801, on the eve of what ultimately, of course, becomes the two-term presidency of Thomas Jefferson. But this is a moment in time, of course, when there is very much a question hanging in the air of who is going to be the third president. As you describe this very, very unsettling moment, not only in the life of Thomas Jefferson, but in the life of this young nation, you say that now a quarter century after the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson believed that the United States, as he knew it and loved it, might not long endure. And of course, here we are now in the year 2013 in the United States of America. We know full well that rough times or not, the U.S. ultimately does endure. It's probably really important to try to put ourselves back into the mind of someone like Thomas Jefferson at this point in our history when the future is so much more tenuous.
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the reasons to look at history, to think about biography, is to achieve a sense of proportionality. You know, how does the crisis of the present moment stack up against crises of the past? It's one of the reasons I do this, is to try to get some sense of, you know, is the debt ceiling battle really Fort Sumter or the election of 1801, or is it something else? And without that perspective, I don't think there's any way to really rationally try to move forward. Jefferson dealt with existential crises his whole life because he was, in fact, part of a generation that was creating something new. He said in a letter to Joseph Priestley after that very narrow election in 1801, which he almost lost, not with the people, but in Washington. He almost lost it with, you know, there was confusion in the Electoral College. His own running mate was essentially running against him, Aaron Burr. There was talk that they might make John Marshall, then the Chief Justice, and the Secretary of State. He was sort of concurrently serving. Might make him president for a year until they could work it out. We now have the sense that, of course, every 4 years we have this orderly transition. Well, that was the first, that was only the second contested election. 1796 was the first contested election. Adams won. 1800 was only the second. And it took 36, 37 ballots in the House of Representatives before Jefferson won. So the whole thing was tenuous. You know, as Wellington said of Waterloo, it was the damnedest close-run thing you ever saw in your life. And I think that, at least in, for me anyway, trying to understand how close we came to disaster or what went into averting disaster is incredibly useful in the broadest sense in understanding what we're supposed to be doing, what we ought to be doing now. Not that there's a way to, you know, send for Jefferson to deal with a debt ceiling. That's anachronistic. I don't mean that. But if we don't understand how the earlier generations fought these battles, then I don't think we're ever going to be able to judge exactly where we stand in terms of the level of crisis and the level of difficulty that we face.
Hmm. You say quite firmly that Thomas Jefferson was the most successful political figure of the first part of the 19th century, both for his own presidency and so many presidents who followed after him, who very much followed in his footsteps, politically speaking. Among many fascinating areas that we could discuss, but with our time just about gone, I'm choosing just one for no particular reason, but I think if we just talk for a moment or two about it, it'll give listeners a sense of all the richness of your book and of this portrait. One of the most intriguing things about Thomas Jefferson is his religious faith, or lack thereof, or what I think you at one point term a rather kind of unconventional belief system for that time and place. And this has been one bone of contention in understanding who he was and the way in which different people have reacted to Thomas Jefferson to some extent hinges on this. Would you mind just saying a word about this complicated facet of Thomas Jefferson?
Absolutely. He was, that's exactly right. He was an unconventional believer, but he was a believer. He believed in a creator God. He believed, interestingly, in a system, a future system of rewards and punishments. He believed in a kind of consciousness of the soul. He thought that he and John Adams are up there right now, wherever there is, looking down, listening to us, which would please Jefferson immensely and Adams not so much. So there was a kind of Aristotelian sense of that. He was in no way a Christian in the way we would think of it. He did not think that the creeds of the church that came up and rose out of the understanding of the life of Jesus of Nazareth were legitimate. He called it monkish superstition. He called the Holy Trinity the mere abracadabra of men calling themselves the priests of Jesus. He tried to create his own Bible. Presidents have very few ego problems, but no one else has ever tried to rewrite the New Testament. But Jefferson did, to try to remove the superstitious elements, the mystical elements, and try to recover what he believed to be the moral philosophy at the heart of the Jesus story. It would be almost impossible for Jefferson to win an election today with those religious views. He was much more of a seeker in many ways, of a intellectual about the role of faith. But he did appreciate, and this is an important point, he did appreciate the cultural role of faith as something in the life of a republic that held it together. And so his great goal in fighting for religious liberty was to make sure religion was only one factor among many in shaping the life of the country, that it would never become dominant, but at the same time, you would never persecute people simply on religious grounds. Hmm.
At one point early in the book, you write, Jefferson was a breathing human being who was subject to the passion and prejudice and pride and love and ambition and hope and fear that drive most other breathing human beings. And of course, as you go on to say, the whole aim of your marvelous book is to try to paint a rich, vibrant portrait of exactly that, Thomas Jefferson as a human being. The book is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, published by Random House, and its author, John Meacham. John Meacham, thank you so much for making time in your busy schedule to talk with me about this really fascinating book, and I thank you again for writing it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Next week on The Morning Show, we have a number of interesting things to offer up, including on Monday the rebroadcast of a conversation from several years ago with Shelby Steele, the author of an intriguing book called White Guilt. We are rebroadcasting during the month of December a handful of Morning Show conversations which have been in and around the topic of racism in America. On Tuesday, we will be talking with several people who are helping to organize the Longest Night concert, which is coming up next Sunday, the 21st, which is a remembrance for those in the last year who were homeless, who perished while out in the elements. It's a call to action for a greater concern for the homeless in our community. Next week, we'll also preview for you the upcoming 10th anniversary Sing-Along Messiah at First United Methodist Church. And we'll also be talking with the author of a new biography of one of America's most famous sportscasters, Al Michaels. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Click on Talk. A reminder that tomorrow, beginning at 11 a.m., it is the next high-definition simulcast from the Metropolitan Opera, Wagner's great masterwork, Die Meistersinger, again beginning 1 hour earlier than normal at 11 a.m. at Tinseltown in Kenosha and the Renaissance in Racine. Cloudy today with a high of 37 degrees, overnight a low of 30. Cloudy again tomorrow, but we'll be warming up into the low 40s for a high. Similar temperature on Sunday. On Monday, actually, we'll warm all the way up to 49 degrees with a good chance of rain. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.